Hello and welcome to another episode of the Student Loan Planner Podcast. I am your host, Travis Hornsby, and today we will talk about student loan companies that are going out of business and what it means for you. We will go into some great detail because some of these companies going out of business will have a bigger impact on your life, and some of them will have a more muted impact. It's not us, thank goodness, yay. We're still very much in business, somehow continuing to grow during all of this. But it does seem to me that the economy is starting to really get wobbly. I'm just seeing some things. We have a lot of different advertisers on our site, mortgage lenders, student loan refinancing companies, companies that offer different kinds of products. And it's very clear that we're not, you know, we actually might be in a recession. We had a negative GDP growth last quarter. And if you have another quarter of negative GDP growth, that's the technical definition of a recession. So we will see what's going on there. Basically, what's going on at a macro level before I jump into kind of like the core idea of today's podcast is the Federal Reserve realizes that they messed up. Federal Reserve realizes that they said inflation was transitory, that it was a temporary pricing dislocation due to the pandemic, and it turns out they were wrong. They kept monetary policy too loose for too long, and now we've got the worst inflation in 40 years, really since the 1970s. And early 1980s. And so the Federal Reserve, just like kind of the era of Paul Volcker, who was the guy that broke inflation when it was double digits in the 80s with super high increases in the short-term federal funds rate, just like that happened back then, what's happening now is the Federal Reserve is raising short-term interest rates to intentionally slow down lending activity in the economy to try to bring down the level of inflation to stabilize prices. A lot of times when they do this, it causes a recession. So this is a big deal. This could have some big impacts on the cost of borrowing if you're buying a house, if you have any other things you're trying to borrow for, like starting a business, buying a practice, or refinancing your student loans. Interest costs for doing all of those things might be significantly higher in the coming months, as they already are a lot higher, frankly. This is also causing, whenever you cause a recession, right, it also causes pain for companies, big and small. And some of these companies are facing so much pain that they're effectively going out of business. Now, in the case of the companies that we're going to talk about today, I think it's more about them pivoting to different product lines versus straight up going out of business or strategically phasing themselves out in ways that are not the same as like, oh, Lehman collapsed overnight, nobody was expecting it. That's kind of what I mean. So let's talk first about the company that's going out of business that will have a much bigger impact on your life if you're going for a forgiveness-based strategy. So we're going to talk first about Great Lakes Servicing. So it seems like Great Lakes Student Loan Servicing is going to be quitting the loan servicing business. Now, this is not as big of a deal as it sounds because they are owned by Nelnet, and it seems like what Nelnet has decided to do is to transfer all the loan accounts that are at Great Lakes to Nelnet. And I think the reason they would do this is they're two separate brands doing the same thing, and they purchased Great Lakes, and I think, you know, didn't want to mess anything up with Great Lakes business, at least for a while. And this makes a lot of sense to move them all over before the payment restart actually happens again. It kind of makes a lot of sense. Maybe they save on costs for maintaining websites, maintaining, you know, employment counts. Probably they get some savings there where they don't need to have quite as many managers or project people or tech people, things like that. This is really more of a strategic decision, I think, by Nelnet more so than it is Great Lakes firing themselves, like what happened with Navient and FedLoan. FedLoan and Navient basically said, we don't want to be a part of this anymore. We're out. Get us out right now. And that was very much them just deciding this is just not worth the pain and not worth the effort based off of what's going on. Anyways, I think that with Great Lakes phasing themselves out and Nelnet taking over, what we're going to see is a new mega servicer. The new mega servicer is going to have 15 million borrower accounts. That's a lot. Number two is Advantage with 7 million borrower accounts. So basically, the new servicer is going to be servicing more than a third of all student loans. And plus, guess what? Their contract is set to not be renewed in the next generation servicing environment. So Nelnet is basically got an expiring contract, and Department of Ed said they're probably not going to move forward with them. So Nelnet's response is to become too big to fail and dare Department of Ed to drop them, knowing that it would be catastrophic for borrowers. And I don't overstate that. If Nelnet actually did quit and another servicer filled in for them, the impact on borrowers would be awful. because you've got Nelnet and Great Lakes. Great Lakes is actually the top rated servicer of all the different servicers that we have covered over the years. Great Lakes always has the best customer service ratings. I'm not saying best as in like they're anything to call home about, but it's like if you're the best of the worst, that actually means you're somewhat competent. Great Lakes and Nelnet's generally number two on those ratings. So, you know, you're going to have this too big to fail servicer that's got the best customer service ratings compared to two servicers that are brand new. I would think the Department of Education, frankly, would be stupid to let go of Nelnet. I'm just being honest there. If they let go of Nelnet, it's probably the dumbest decision the Department of Education could make on student loan servicing, at least right now. Maybe they make it so that you don't always have to have them in the mix, but to get rid of them in any time in the next couple years would be really dumb, in my opinion. And let's talk about why. Aidvantage is a subsidiary of Maximus. So Aidvantage, you might have gotten something in the mail from them. They're taking over for Navient. So Aidvantage is this subsidiary of this Maximus group that manages student loan defaults currently. That's what they used to do for Department of Ed. Still probably will be doing that, but Aidvantage is this new subsidiary group that's like managing all the federal student loan servicing business for them. And honestly, this is just my random opinion. My guess is that Aidvantage, you know, Maximus, which owns them, decided to get into student loan servicing, and the Department of Ed chose them simply because they had the best bid, low price, and that's kind of what Department of Ed's looking for. You know, who cares about customer service, right? Low price, you know, already have a relationship with them, so let's try these new people out, okay? And then we also know that Mohila is taking over for FedLoan servicing. FedLoan obviously got a lot of attacks and criticism for their poor management of student loan servicing. And a lot of that's true. A lot of it's because Congress wrote the PSLF rules in an awful way. So a lot of it is FedLoan's fault. Let's be frank about that. But also let's be frank that a lot of the problems with PSLF are absolutely nothing to do with FedLoan servicing. It's because Congress wrote the rules because they didn't really know what they were doing, in my opinion. And I think that they almost sort of wrote the program in a way that would intentionally cause a lot of problems. I don't know why, but that's kind of what they did. So with Mohila taking over, why did Mohila win this next gen contract? Basically, the student loan servicer contracts expire every few years, and then they're up for renewal, and Department of Ed can move in a different direction if they want to. And they did decide to move in a completely new direction during the Trump administration. It was kind of a shocker that Nelnet initially didn't get one of the contracts, and these new companies did. I think Ed Financial was one of the ones that was in the mix. But if you think about why, you know, why Mohila? Mohila is the Missouri Higher Education Loan Authority. My guess is the reason that Mohila got this contract for taking over from FedLoan is because, one, I believe they're a not-for-profit servicer, I think. Two, Missouri is a state where the number three at the time, right? This was during the Trump administration. I think the number three senator at the time was Roy Blunt, who's a senior senator from Missouri. And then Ed Financial won. Why? I think it's headquartered in Knoxville, and Senator Lamar Alexander at the time was chair of the Senate Education Committee. Politics matters. And the funny thing is Blunt and Alexander are or already have retired. So who knows? Will Ed Financial be taking over from Nelnet, and Department of Ed will let Nelnet exit the business? I have no idea. But what generally happens, here's kind of the reason why you shouldn't panic about this. First of all, Nelnet and Great Lakes, you know, Nelnet owns Great Lakes. So that's not the same thing as like Navient leaving and going over to Aidvantage, because it's two different companies, whereas these are the same companies. They're just putting everything under their Nelnet brand and umbrella. So I wouldn't be super worried about this. Remember that your data is all stored in the centralized NSLDS data file on studentaid.gov. So you don't have to worry about anything in that regard. Because it's already all in there, all the data is there, so it's not like you're losing anything by Great Lakes going away. You know, for Parent Plus borrowers, I'm a little concerned because it might be a little bit more difficult to do double consolidations for people that are trying to get access to repay instead of ICR, because you'll have, instead of four servicers to choose from, you're basically now going to have three. It definitely is a little bit of a challenge that we're going to be facing with them phasing out of business. I think the servicers, this to me, this action is a preview of the fact that I think servicers are about to fight harder back against Congress. You might say, how could they do that? Well, you might say, what leverage do they have? Well, think about what each of the parties use the servicers for. I think Republicans tend to view servicers as a cost center where we want to allocate as little as possible to student loan servicing, maybe make it just kind of a low bid contract and not worry about things like customer service. And, you know, honestly, if the servicers do a better job, then people probably get more loan forgiveness, right? So it's kind of like this idea of, I think a Republican senator might have the view of, oh, well, let's starve the beast and not have any, have the minimal amount possible dedicated to student loan servicing. Now, Democrats, I think, view student loan servicing as something that we should spend more money on to get better customer service for borrowers that would result in more forgiveness. But then the more progressive wing of the party, I think, really uses servicers as a political punching bag. Politicians made the loan programs, and I think progressives would be right to be very frustrated with Congress not doing anything about these loan programs and not taking advantage of legislation to simplify the IDR plans and just make one plan that's a lot easier to administer. But what's happened is, you know, administrations, primarily Democratic administrations, have used the executive order process to make new loan repayment programs to extend more relief to borrowers. But when they do this, the constraints are that they have to make it more limited eligibility. You can't do as much through executive action as you can through legislation, right? So then they have to put all these weird rules in place, like pay as you earn is only for people that are new borrowers after October 2007, but and also have to take out one new loan after October 2011, right? Just really confusing stuff. You know, that's why we have four different IDR plans, and we're about to have a fifth, is because Congress can't pass anything, so executive action is the only path forward. And then when you do all this, it makes things so complicated that the student loan servicers have to implement it. And frankly, during this period of, gazillion extensions of the student loan payment and interest pause, as well as the PSLF waiver, the IDR waiver announcements, the administration apparently has not given the servicers any advance notice or guidance whatsoever, which in my opinion is just really inexcusable. I mean, how are you supposed to do a good job helping borrowers if you're not even giving any guidance to the people that you've hired to help them? That would be like if, I don't know, I'm just trying to come up with an analogy. It would be like if I hired one company to manage a bunch of lawn care providers or something like that. And then I just made an announcement that we were going to, I don't know, only use a certain kind of equipment or something, and then gave the person I hired to manage all these subcontractors just no guidance whatsoever and just hope they would figure it out. I mean, that's a bad analogy, I guess. You could really think of a lot of different better analogies, I'm sure, but it's basically like the person you hired to do a job, you're making a massive announcement that's going to cause a gazillion questions from borrowers, and you're giving them no guidance at all on how to answer those questions. So that is one of the reasons I think why a company like ours has grown during this time, is because you have all these clues and things put out in different places where you can put two and two together and you can figure out what's going to happen, and you can help people make actionable decisions that save them a massive amount of money, you know, if you're an expert in this space. And if you're just, you know, a financial planner who's casually dabbling in student loans or dabbles in it occasionally, how can you possibly keep up with things that move as quickly as student loans unless you do this all day, every day? You know, you've got PSLF waiver, suddenly an IDR waiver, suddenly there's a test on how you're going to get extra credit for forbearance or not. And you have to be able to identify that in the, you know, NSLDS file. And it's just stuff's constantly changing, which is one of the reasons why you don't have a JP Morgan student loan servicing, a student loan advice company out there, because this thing moves too fast and it's not a billion-dollar business. It's millions of dollar type of business globally at a global level, which means some of the bigger companies aren't as excited about entering it, I guess. But it's what we do. It's the core of what we do, is providing the very best student loan help anywhere in the world. And it's because I think it's part of our mission to help you live your best life possible. And that at the end is what we're all trying to do, is to get you to live the life you want. And taking away student loans is a stressor in that. So with final thought about this Nelnet-Great Lakes merger, I think they have to keep around Nelnet simply because the two new servicers, Advantage and Mohila, don't have a lot of experience managing student loans. So you really do need Great Lakes and Nelnet to at least be in the mix for, you know, at least a couple more years, in my opinion, to try to just hopefully smoothly get people back into repayment. And I don't know, you know, the new name of the new servicer combined will still probably be Nelnet, But wouldn't it be interesting if you rename the new service, or maybe the Great Net, or my personal favorite, the Lakes of Nell. Great Lakes plus Nelnet, get it? The Lakes of Nell. Imagine getting a bill in the mail from the Lakes of Nell. Sounds like something much darker. And I'm just joking. Just try to make sure you're awake and still listening. But yeah, so just prepare for that. Great Lakes, people, you're going to see Nelnet make an announcement. Your loans will move over. Make sure your contact information's updated. You log in and create an account. Make sure your stuff is set up with autopay on Nelnet. Just do all the best practices for whenever your servicer changes. So just be aware of that. Okay, now let's talk about the one other company that's going out of business that I wanted to talk about in today's podcast episode. So they're not going out of business, but their student loan division is. Common Bond is now done doing student loans. They've been a partner of ours since really the very beginning, since 2016. So they've done this for a long time, and they're out. And this is pretty stunning to me. This is showing that student loan refinancing is under a lot of economic headwinds. You've got a lot higher interest rates combined with probably almost 3 years of zero interest that you're competing against. And they did some great promos several months back where they would do zero interest for 6 months and then lock your rate at like something really low after that. First thing I want to say is if your loans are refinanced through Common Bond, actually nothing changes. You're still going to be serviced by the same servicer. You're still going to have all the same terms of your loan. There's literally nothing else that changes. Basically, what Common Bond's pivoting into getting into the solar financing business. So if like you wanted to buy solar panels for your home and you wanted a way to finance that, that's one of the big things they're doing now is financing people's solar energy installations. And I think they'll give you like a discount if you're a current Common Bond borrower for student loans. So this is really an interesting development. We've never had a student loan refinancing company really just shut down before. And this is the first major one that I've ever seen do it. I wonder if there's going to be more. That's ultimately, I think, bad for consumers, because what that means is when you have fewer companies making loans, companies that are left over don't have to offer as competitive deals. Student loan refinancing companies don't offer really low interest rates and cashback bonuses out of the goodness of their hearts. They do so because it makes business sense to do that, because the market's very competitive and you need incentives to attract new applicants. And this is just one of the ways they do that. And I'm interested to see how this develops. I will say that out of the companies that are still around, kind of the three that seem to be, I should really say sort of the top four that I'm seeing right now are Laurel Road, Splash, Credible, and SoFi. So on our site, studentloanplanner.com/refi, Earnest is also in the mix there. But you know, I would just go to studentloanplanner.com/refi and apply with the companies that you see in the top of the table. If you have private loans, you know, I'm going to be honest, I'm not sure you're going to be able to get a much lower rate than what you already have. It's possible. I think, you know, Laurel Road and Splash in particular seem like they're still being pretty aggressive. But it's going to become a lot tougher. You're just seeing interest rates go up across the board. We're seeing that in student loan refi. To be honest, the student loan interest pause lasting from getting extended past January 31st honestly cost our borrowers a lot more money than they've saved. And you might say, well, that's not true. Well, no, it is, because you could have refinanced. A lot of people could have refinanced at like 2.9 for 20-year fixed if they'd applied with the loan pause expiring end of January. People would have locked that in for 20 years, and with inflation being at 8% or 9%, you wouldn't have probably touched that loan ever again, to be honest. You might have just kept that loan around forever. And instead, now we're dealing with people refinancing at much higher rates, and by the time the pause expires, the rates might be even higher. So I think that it's one of those weird situations where unintended consequences, right? The administration's trying to help borrowers. After Build Back Better got defeated, they needed a political win. They extend the student loan payment interest pause. Then when they extend it, you can't restart it so close to the midterms. And then it just becomes this political hot potato where you don't know what to do with it. And borrowers, you know, we just have to sort of figure it out. So we'll give you more updates if we see anything new happening there. But I do think rates are still relatively low. That's the other thing I'd say is rates could get a lot worse. Why would you refinance federal student loans right now? I probably would wait a little bit just to see what happens with the public health emergency order and whether or not they're going to extend the payment interest pause again after August 31st. But you might still refinance now simply because if you think that rates are going to continue to go up, which they might, then you could continue to lose a lot more money. You know, lots of things to think about. We'll talk about that more in future episodes. Let's talk about some IDR waiver stuff. Got some stuff, some clues based off of updates to the PSLF waiver FAQ page. We are still waiting for the IDR waiver FAQ. The day that I recorded this, we're a month in, and it's just frankly ridiculous. If somebody that knows somebody at the Department of Ed has any power over this, or actually works at the Department of Ed, please encourage whoever's job it is to publish the FAQ for the IDR waiver to do your freaking job. This was announced clearly with no planning, with no thought put into it, with no detailed, analysis of the impacts and how many people would be eligible for forgiveness and cancellation. And that's inexcusable. You're trying to help borrowers. I get that. That's a good thing. But, what the Department of Ed's doing right now is sort of like saying, oh, look, there's a entrenched artillery position on the hill. Let's just go charge and just see what happens. It's not a good plan. You need to have a plan in place to implement something, or else you're just being reckless. And that's really what the Department of Ed is doing right now, I think. You're kind of staring down probable loss of at least one chamber of Congress in the midterm elections, which I get would be a motivator to act and to act now to help borrowers, because you're going to have your Department of Ed people get hauled in front of Congress for investigations on all kinds of things if one of the chambers does change. So you do have a very limited window of opportunity to help people. I get that. And you're needing to do all this before the public health emergency expires too. I get that. But put things into overdrive. I mean, like, motivate your staff to put in extra hours, try to work hard to get this work done to help borrowers. I don't know. Maybe this is me being a sort of a privileged jerk, somebody that owns a private company that has an incentive to help people monetarily, versus if you're a government worker, maybe you don't have those same incentives. And so you're asking people to do a ton more work in a very short amount of time. But I don't know, don't most people in public service get into it to help people? Just seems bizarre to me that it would take this long to publish a simple FAQ about the IDR waiver. So I would love to see that if somebody at Department of Ed wants to put in the time, or if we could help even, let us know. podcast@studentloanplanner.com, send us an email. But we'd love to see some more effort put in by Department of Ed to fix this problem. But anyways, the clues that we got based off of these new additions to the PSLF waiver FAQ page, which is a page that we stalk all the time to make sure that our advice is up to the minute accurate. Basically, what it sounds like is they're going to give PSLF credit for any kind of deferment besides in-school deferment before 2013. After 2013 and after, only economic hardship deferment is going to count for purposes of PSLF. That's the first time we've seen that kind of written down in paper. For forbearances, they have said that they're only going to be counting forbearances before COVID. So that means that you have to have a 12 months or greater consecutive forbearance, or a 36 month or greater aggregate forbearance for those to be counted. And those forbearances have to be before the pandemic. So that was one of the big questions we had, is, well, everybody's had, almost 3 years worth of forbearance due to the pandemic. Is that going to automatically be included? And does that mean that basically everybody gets all kinds of credit for forbearance for PSLF? Seems like the answer to that is no. So the PSLF waiver stuff, it kind of just confirmed our thinking there, kind of confirmed what we'd already predicted. So that's good to see that down in writing. And I think that once we do have an eventual IDR waiver FAQ published, I think the same stuff is gonna be there. Still haven't received any kind of information as to an effective date for this, if the IDR waiver is only going to be applicable for forbearances or deferments or something after a certain date, because with the PSLF waiver, it's stuff after October 2007 when PSLF was passed can count. Whereas, with this IDR waiver, it seems like it's more open-ended. So we're still waiting on that. We'll let you know as soon as we hear something on that. Let's talk about cancellation real quick. What's the deal with that? Looks like there's going to be means testing on this if they do it, but there's been all kinds of interesting opposition from places I wouldn't expect. So there was an op-ed by the editorial board of the New York Times that basically said, don't cancel debt, which was pretty shocking to see that come from the New York Times. Washington Post editorial board also came out and said, hey, this is probably something that we shouldn't do for everybody. And there's a lot of support, it seems like, of helping people that are in economic distress, lower income borrowers, people that are in default. Seems like there's a lot of widespread support among moderate Democrats for doing something like that. But it seems like you're what I would call Obama Democrats, your more pragmatic wing of the Democratic Party, or you could call it moderate wing of the Democratic Party, versus, say, a Sanders or Warren wing, which is going to be more progressive, right? That more moderate wing really, I think, doesn't support canceling across the board for everybody. And I don't know actually how much support canceling $10K in Congress for every borrower would even get legislatively. I think that you might only get 40 votes for that, to be honest, out of, you know, the 50 Democrats that are in the Senate, which is why I think another reason why this needs to happen by executive order instead of through Congress. President Biden is doing this, I believe, with full knowledge that it's going to get challenged legally. And I think that it's probably smart politics for them to do this, because what do they have to lose, right? If you're down in the polls, you are worried about turnout from your base, you need to do something to energize your base to get them out to vote. And your biggest approval rating, net approval rating decline has happened among young voters, which is some demographic that you really need to turn out. What's going to happen based off of the best available information as of recording? What we think is the amount's going to be less than 10K. It's probably going to be 10. Could be a little bit more than that, but probably will be 10. The payment restart will probably also be linked to a cancellation announcement. So when they do announce their plan for cancellation, we think they will also at the same time announce their plan for getting people back into repayment. But when they announce cancellation, what will immediately happen is that a Republican allied group or Republicans directly will file a lawsuit against this somewhere, probably in a friendly jurisdiction. So think about the mask mandate. That lawsuit was filed in a very friendly jurisdiction in a Florida court with, you know, ended up getting a judge that was appointed by President Trump, who's a very conservative judge, it seems like. I would expect the same pattern for a cancellation lawsuit against that. So here's just a random student loan nerd type of factoid. There was a Republican named, I think his name is Wayne Johnson, who worked in federal student aid, kind of a random guy. I think he was kind of high up in federal student aid, but still somewhat of a random Republican, made a long shot bid for the Georgia Senate based off of supporting canceling student debt or forgiving some student loan debt for people. Although he said that he would sue to block student loan cancellation done by executive action, which is really interesting that one of the lone Republicans that got a lot of press coverage based off of him supporting student loan cancellation would block it, would try to sue to block it if the order was made via executive order. The theory there is separation of powers. Congress has power of the purse, not the president. The president, by canceling student loan debt, is effectively spending hundreds of billions of dollars without paying for it, which is technically Congress's purview, is the legal argument that's made. Other people make the argument that, no, the secretary has the authority to waive or, you know, modify obligations from borrowers, and that this, maybe by the emergency authority during the pandemic, they might have the power due to that, or they might have the power just in general based on the Higher Education Act, is what the most progressive legal experts argue. When you have an argument like this, though, it gets settled in the courts, because something that costs hundreds of billions of dollars and draws the ire of moderates in the Republican Party is going to be something that gets a lot more attention and energy behind a lawsuit. Another example of this, Mitt Romney on Twitter called student loan cancellation by executive order. His quote was something like, I'm quoting him again. He said something like, it's a bribe akin to paying for people's cars or houses. So when you've got a Mitt Romney that's coming out forcefully against it, somebody that voted to impeach the president, somebody that will often support more bipartisan type of bills, this is something that is going to get a legal challenge. So if the cancellation announcement is linked to the payment restart, what happens if they file a lawsuit against it, get a stay so that Department of Ed can't start implementing that, and then it gets appealed all the way to the Supreme Court? Does the administration then use the appeals process to say, well, you know, we can't start repayments because everything's hung up in the courts and we have to see what happens in the courts first before we can restart repayments? Maybe they do that, you know, and then maybe what happens is they get an announcement that comes out right before the midterms, which maybe motivates people, along with the recent Roe v. Wade leak of the draft opinion at the Supreme Court. And maybe that's part of the overall electoral strategy for Democrats, is sort of you need somebody to run against. And if you're the party in charge, you can't run against the other party as the party who messed things up. So then you need to find someone to run against. And, you know, the Supreme Court would be maybe an effective foil, given the economic environment that Democrats are facing. maybe that's part of the strategy. Maybe you intentionally get the theme could be an obstruction of Supreme Court that blocks reproductive rights and student loan cancellation. And maybe that's a way to turn out the base. I'm just speculating on this, by the way, because I think it's kind of useful just to think about all the different things that could happen. Ultimately, will cancellation of any amount up to $10K help most of you listening to this? Probably not, because most of the people that we talk to, right, are people that owe a lot, people that have graduate degrees that might owe $100K or $200K or $400K, and $10K is sort of a drop in the bucket compared to a more generous income-based plan that might happen, right? But cancellation is basically the only thing the media wants to cover. You could maybe make an argument the reason why is only 3 million people owe six figures of student loans and 40-something million, 42 million owe some amount of student loans. So there's just a lot more eyeballs interested in student loan cancellation than a more generous income-based plan, for example. So here's a crazy idea that is probably very, very crazy. So I want to preface it with that. I did say that there's almost zero chance that payments restart August 31st, but maybe there's a non-zero chance that they do now. And just hear me out as to this is very speculative, but if you do announce some cancellation and you do allow the emergency authority due to the pandemic to expire, then maybe you can't extend it, or maybe you want to start payments again because you know that voters' number one concern is inflation, and allowing the student loan pause to continue looks inflationary optically, even though it might not matter all that much in the grand scheme of things. And so if you're the Democratic Party, maybe you say, well, maybe we do cancellation and then restart repayments. There's been some clues like that since Secretary Cardona was on a MSNBC interview recently and said that eventually borrowers will need to start paying what they can afford, which seems to be a signal that they are thinking about restarting repayments. The question is when. You know, maybe inflation becomes more important than getting more relief for student loan borrowers and trying to turn out the base through the strategy, which probably is true. You probably do need to focus completely on inflation to mitigate your losses because, frankly, from what I've seen, people don't vote based on things like student loans. It just doesn't really move the dial that much, even though people say it does. You know, it doesn't seem like in actuality when people list what are your top reasons for voting, student loans almost don't ever make the top 10 reasons, frankly. So we will see. I would not be super surprised either if they sort of announced with a cancellation announcement that they are going to do one final extension and then it's going to expire December 31st or January 31st or something like that. So I could also see that happening. Remember that the National Emergency Declaration from the Department of Health, they said they would give 60 days notice before that order expires. That's supposed to expire July 15th. When I'm recording this, that they should be announcing that very shortly as to whether or not they're going to extend that. And depending on their telegraphing of that, that also gives us clues as to how long the payment and interest pause would be. So another big update, there'll be a new IDR plan announced this summer, the rulemaking process, they're going through what that's going to look like. I'm curious how generous that's going to be. I could see graduate borrowers getting included in that, but I wouldn't be super shocked to see a split of grad versus undergrad in terms of forgiveness dates, like, you know, 15 years for undergrad, 20 years for grad school. Maybe you do repay, right? So maybe you do repay, but you just do, instead of 20 and 25 years, maybe you make it 15 and 20 years. Maybe you do 10% of your income with 300% poverty line deduction. If I had to just guess randomly right now, you know, as to what this new plan is going to look like, that would just be my guess, is if they wanted to go big, the way I think they would go big would be repay for everybody, including Parent PLUS borrowers, 15 years for undergrad, 20 years for grad, bigger poverty line deduction. That would be what I would view as them going big. I don't think that they're going to go way bigger than what the current plans are. Like, in other words, I think most people would save maybe $100 to $200 a month in lower payments, depending on what they end up doing. I don't think that we're going to see something really shocking, like a 5% of your income type of plan. I do not think we're going to see something like that. It would be interesting to see if they allow people to file separately or not. One of the arguments progressives make is, well, we should make one plan that's just frankly better than every single other plan. Another thing to kind of pay attention to is how are they going to deal with negative amortization? In other words, the balance growing over time. Will that balance grow over time by them, you know, forgiving the interest or something like that? Like the repay interest subsidy is 100%, I think, for the first 3 years for subsidized loans, and then, or it might be longer than that, actually, I have to double check. But then it's 50% forever for the unsubsidized loans. You know, is there a world where they just say, well, we're going to give you a subsidy of all of your unpaid interest every month? That could be something to follow too. So we'll be covering that closely as the summer goes on. That will actually be a far more important announcement when the details of that plan get published versus what they're going to do on cancellation or payment restarts, because that's just going to be kind of moving the dials on a couple months worth of payments versus potentially getting a lot more forgiven. And keep in mind, too, that the group that's calling for a far more generous income-based plan is really the Senator Warren wing of the party, the progressive wing of the Democratic Party. Usually when they call for something, whatever they call for, they get less. So Senator Warren calls for 50, they get 10. You know, so that's kind of what I would expect with this IBR plan, is they're calling for something super generous and maybe they get something generous. Maybe one or two more random things to mention here. The peak season for private student loans is upon us. What this means is basically for people that have kids going to undergrad or kids that are in undergrad, generally speaking, a lot of people will choose to get private student loans to pay for the extra costs that they can't afford to pay out of pocket for school. And you might say, well, why would you ever use private student loans instead of Parent PLUS loans? The only reason is because you want your kid to have skin in the game. So if you're going to, you know, send your kid to a super expensive private school, there would really be, in my opinion, no reason to use private student loans, because the Parent PLUS loans could be, you know, you could take out as much as you want there and get them eligible for forgiveness, right? But if you're only going to be taking out, you know, 10, 20K for someone's education, then a private student loan might make a lot of sense, because you put your kid's name on that loan too. And the origination fees for Parent PLUS loans are about 4.25%, which is like an upfront fee. And then the new interest rate for them is around, you know, 7.5, I think. So that's very high. And some people could get lower interest in addition to putting their kid's name on the loan and making them legally responsible for it too. So we do have some private student loan companies. This, again, is for people that are parents of undergrads or undergrads. You know, if there are any people in undergrad listening to this podcast, this might also be something you'd look into. If you're wanting to see what your options would be, you can go to studentloanplanner.com/private. So studentloanplanner.com/private, and get connected with some of the top originators of private student loans to pay for your undergrad degree. Most of the people listening to this are probably in grad school or post-grad school, post-professional school people. But some of our folks, as we have our population that grows, some folks do have teenagers that are going to college. And I thought that I would mention that in case that resource helps anybody. We continue to do a lot of student loan consults. Please book now for months into the future if you need to. So studentloanplanner.com/book. You can choose a time far into the summer, in mid or even late summer, once we know more about the IDR waiver and payment restart stuff and the new IDR plan. We will continue to get very busy around those times when the big news breaks. So you can always reserve your spot now, and then just at least with 24 hours notice, you can reschedule, use a reschedule link to bump that plan out later if you need to. But go ahead and reserve your time now, because the booking calendar is really the craziest I've ever seen it. Thank you, everybody. If you have any questions, studentloanplanner.com/voicemail leaves a question for the pod. And if you have any comments, we always love to get them. And I hope you have a wonderful week.